Nuclear theater. How does one tell the story of the inhumanity of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki through the very human shared experience of live theater? No James Cameron Oppenheimer level budget, not even close. No overwhelming special effects. No elaborate sets, costumes, or casts of thousands or CGI. Just a group of amateur actors, mostly college students, each one holding a copy of the script in hand and reading from it on a bare stage with the only set consisting of risers, chairs, two tables, and an open area for limited interaction. Is such a thing even possible? Can it work? Did it? Well, it takes the woman who directed a staged reading of the play to fill you in. And when she tells you...
You know, I think one of the best things is to hear people since last night say, oh my gosh, I'm not a history person. I was so drawn into this production. I just couldn't get enough of it. I just wanted to hear more. I mean, even high school kids that came were saying, I wasn't real sure what was happening in the beginning, and the more I heard, the more I got sucked in, and I wanted to know more. And they learned so much in one night. I just can't help but think that they're researching today and trying to find out more.
Well, when Tara Liddy, director of the world premiere staged reading of Atomic Bill and the Payment Due for the Wilmington College Peace Resource Center's 50th anniversary celebration, provides that kind of feedback on the show, and so much more, you begin to realize that maybe the arts, and specifically theater, and most specifically this play, can help us find a way out of that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a very special episode. My play, Atomic Bill and the Payment Due, was given a world premiere staged reading by the Wilmington College Peace Resource Center in Wilmington, Ohio. It was a featured presentation of the PRC's 50th anniversary celebration, and attracted more than 150 people to witness what a staged reading could do to influence the nuclear conversation. Turns out, quite a lot. We'll have interviews with the director, producer, and actors about what it was like to be so immersed in this story of media manipulation at the dawn of the atomic age. We'll hear from them how the audience and their friends reacted. Along with that, you will hear my personal response in the immediate wake of the presentation. And we'll feature a profile on the Peace Resource Center, its art exhibit memorializing the Hibakusha experience, and an exploration of the importance of this little-known but information-rich resource tucked away at a tiny Quaker college in Ohio. Today is Tuesday, September 23rd, 2025, and here is this very special episode of Nuclear Hot Seat. I first learned about the Peace Resource Center of Wilmington College during a Zoominar on nuclear issues back in October 2023. On chat, we were encouraged to introduce ourselves to each other, and I caught the post of Tanya Mouse. She is the director of the Peace Resource Center, to be referred to as PRC, and mentioned it was an archive. Wanting to know more and looking for a place to archive Nuclear Hot Seat, I did what I always do, requested an interview. Tanya was more than accommodating. We initially spoke for Nuclear Hot Seat number 646 on November 7, 2023. First of all, what is the Peace Resource Center and what is your position there?
So the Peace Resource Center houses the Barbara Reynolds Memorial Archives, and it is the largest collection of materials in regard to the human experience of nuclear war vis-a-vis the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in the United States. And we're the only academic center in the United States wholly devoted to understanding the human experience of nuclear war through the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I currently serve as the Peace Resource Center's director.
What kind of materials are there in the Peace Resource Center?
Well, we're primarily an archive, so we have roughly 40 to 50,000 historical documents that span the range from early 1940s all the way up to the present. Our collection is largely concentrated in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. So it's really thinking about the human experience of nuclear war through atomic bombing survivors, and also through nuclear disarmament activists, primarily nuclear disarmament activists in Japan and the United States. So that sort of makes up the large body of our materials. In addition, we have film footage and audio materials that reflect perspectives and viewpoints of nuclear disarmament activists, atomic bombing sufferers. We have numerous artifacts from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan, both from the time of the atomic bombings, but also from the 1950s and 60s and 70s. And so we care for these, we preserve them for the future, and we make them accessible to researchers. We just had a researcher join us from the School of Social Sciences in Paris and spend 2 weeks with us researching materials regarding the French perception of nuclear weapons development in Japan. And so we field researchers all and facilitate research all year round.
How common is it that people want to know about Hiroshima and Nagasaki? I mean, we are in such a war buildup, pro-nuclear threats coming from various places on the globe. How are people able to use the materials from the Peace Resource Center to bolster the concept of peace and put it forth in the world when we are up against such negative pro-nuclear forces?
So we really appreciate academic scholarship that furthers our understanding of state violence and state use of nuclear weapons as an expression of state violence, because that is something we want to come to an end. So that's critical. And I think this topic remains fascinating because it's the ultimate. One of the students in my class said, the state really is a narcissist. And I said, yes, the state really is a narcissist. And these weapons express that narcissism and that cynicism of the state. All states who hold nuclear weapons and would use them toward their civilians and toward other civilians. So we want people to interrogate that fundamental sort of assumption that states are allowed this kind of narcissism and destructive use of force. But on the other hand, we have welcomed a variety of artists, all the way from dancers to photographers to filmmakers, poets, novelists, painters, photographers have used our materials and created innovative works. A few years ago, I collaborated with a colleague. It was her brainchild, and created the Response Project, in which we solicited seven artists from across the country, and they responded to a material or artifact in the collection and created a new piece of work, a musical composition, a film, montage, poems. And we found, I continue to use those to express the desire for peace, the human desire for to find alternatives to resolving conflict. We know that human conflict happens. It's part of our interactions because all human beings are different, but if we could spend as much money and resources towards finding nonviolent solutions to conflict at the personal and local, regional, national, and global levels as we put into these huge weapons, we certainly could impact people's lives and create a more peaceful and higher quality of life. Really like the way that artists take these pieces and make the work of art, the materials of our archives, much more accessible to the public.
If the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat want to learn more about the archive and possibly avail themselves of it, where do they need to go and what do they need to do?
Yeah, so you can go to wilmington.edu/PRC, or you can contact me at prc@wilmington.edu. And I would love to hear from people out there. And I would love for them to come visit Wilmington College.
With Tanya's emphasis on the arts to communicate nuclear information, I did another thing I always do. Told her about my play, Atomic Bill and the Payment Due. It's an Oppenheimer-adjacent true story of media manipulation at the dawn of the atomic age and the New York Times reporter who sold his soul to get the story. She expressed an interest in taking a look, so I sent her the then-current draft. And to my shock and amazement, she said she wanted to present it during the PRC's 50th anniversary celebration in the fall of 2025. She worked out details with the theater department while I rewrote and evolved the script, generating three additional drafts by the time it came up for production. The reading morphed into a staged reading, a very different, more elaborate thing in theater terms, and I was brought to Ohio for a full week that included me addressing five classes, as well as sitting in on rehearsals and giving notes. Along the way, I learned so much more about the amazing Peace Resource Center with director Tanya Maus as my guide. The Peace Resource Center is housed in quite a lovely building, and it seems extremely appropriate for an archive. What is this building? How big is it, and how is it arranged?
So the building that the archives is in is an 1893 two-story wood frame Victorian home. It was the home of the fourth president of the college, a Quaker, before it was passed on to Barbara Reynolds to become the Peace Resource Center. And it's two stories. The bottom floor consists of four rooms and a kitchen. The rooms are gathering spaces. The rooms hold the document collection, our vintage photograph collection, our scrapbook collection, our photo album collection. And then the second floor consists of three major areas. One area is a library, which holds over 800 Japanese language books, scholarship on the atomic bombings from Japan. And the other half of the library holds about 700 books by scholars in English about the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And we continue to collect and add to both collections. And then we have a processing room or workroom of all kinds of materials that are not yet integrated into the collection. And that room consists of 16 millimeter films from the late 1960s and 1970s. Some come from the 50s, actually. A cassette tape collection, which is incredibly valuable, of interviews with major figures across time from the mid-1970s through the early 2000s. We also have a reel-to-reel audio collection, so a really beautiful interview with Studs Terkel and the atomic bombing sufferer Miyoko Matsubara in Chicago in 1964. So we have these amazing multidisciplinary materials. We have a vinyl collection. We have artwork. We have some of the early kitty-e or the cut fabric drawings that were created by atomic bombing sufferers in the years just following the atomic bombings, when there was nothing left but shards of fabric to create images with. There is a lot in the center that is multidisciplinary in addition to the archival documentation.
Who is allowed to come in here and do research? Do they need particular credentials? Do they have to pay a fee? What does it take to come in here and partake of the archive?
So the Peace Resource Center Barbara Reynolds Memorial Archives is open to members of the general public. It's open to scholars, independent researchers, activists who find that the information may support their work. There's no fee to use the archives. You make an appointment by contacting us at the archives. However, if you need us to scan materials, then there is a scanning fee for those materials. And we also go by a gift economy, so it's a kind of need-based system. So if you have the ability to provide more to support the center, then we ask you to do so. And if you don't have any ability or means, you know, then we take that into consideration as well. So the center is open to everyone. The problem is that we are somewhat limited on human resources. So we have to do things by appointment largely. We do keep hours for the public, but it's always good to come and send us an email, give us a heads up. We have had people just stop by and say, I'm on my way from Alaska to Florida, and I just wanted to check things out. And so it's great if we're here, but I definitely want to know if you're coming so I can make plans and be sure that we can show you all the center has to offer.
And is everything housed here, or do you have auxiliary spaces and sheds and rooms and houses and warehouses for the other material that you own?
Most of our, in fact, almost all of our 2D collection and our audiovisual materials are housed in the Peace Resource Center alongside some artifacts. And the center, we've worked over the years to make sure that the center is climate controlled. We have UV filtration on our windows. We regulate and measure the temperature and the UV to make sure that we're preserving and protecting the documents to the best of our ability. Our artifacts are stored in our Quaker Heritage Center Museum collection storage, which is in another building. It's also climate controlled, and we also measure UV and humidity in that collection as well. What's really amazing, we do have some artifacts that come to us from Hiroshima that are in that collection that survived the atomic bombings, but we also have a really amazing 2D poster collection, anti-nuclear poster collection that has not yet been studied and has not been seen. And so for those scholars or activists who are interested in the material and visual culture of the anti-nuclear movement, I really hope someone comes and spends some time with those posters and studies them, gets word of them out into the world, and maybe also at the same time helps us understand them a little bit better.
Tanya pointed out a very important and moving aspect of the Peace Resource Center.
So we're standing right now toward the back of the Peace Resource Center. And this center, of course, was founded by Barbara Reynolds, who was a Quaker nuclear abolitionist. She founded it in 1975. And so I'm standing right here in front of the heart of the archival collection. Here we have about 40,000 documents regarding the human experience of nuclear war. When researchers come here, they often plan a day and then come back for another 2 or 3 weeks because the collection is not large, but it's extremely rich. And most of the documents are printed either on rice paper or airmail paper. So there's a lot more here than immediately sort of you notice when you first see the collection. And there's a quote in front of me from 1985 from the War Resisters League that presents the 24th Annual Peace Award to Barbara Reynolds for her work with the Hibakusha of Japan. And the quote says, "She has taken a burned and screaming fragment of the past, and by forcing us to remember it, given us a chance to shape a future free of the terror of nuclear war." And that's on the award that she was given. And so that is something I walk by every day and read and think about, that burned and screaming fragment of the past to shape a future free of the terror of nuclear war.
One of the major projects for the 50th anniversary is the exhibit Memorializing the Hibakusha Experience, a multimedia presentation of materials from the PRC, many of them never seen in public before. Here, Tanya provides a brief orientation to the exhibit.
All of the archival materials you see here, including these images at the entryway of the exhibition, are curated from the Peace Resource Center archival collection, from the archives. And they've never been seen before publicly in this way. So researchers have seen them. Scholars have come and done research at the center, but we've never exhibited these before in public like this. So this exhibition will be on display at Wilmington College till December 5, 2025, and then it will move to Oakland University outside of Detroit, Michigan from January 2026 through mid-spring 2026.
Will it be available elsewhere after that?
We really would like this exhibition to travel. It's incredibly thoughtfully put together. There's four contemporary artists, Kei Ito, Katie McCormick, Migiwa Ordimo, and Ellen O'Hara Slavic also have their works in this exhibition. And the archival works and the contemporary works by these artists are in dialogue with each other. So it creates a present and past conversation about not only the history of the atomic bombings, but the impact of nuclear weapons development and use on human and natural, environmental, human populations, the environment over time. And so it's really an incredible exhibition. We want it to travel. It has so many exciting components. And I know Claude Bayajan, who's the curator, will also have things to say about this exhibition, how deep and rich it is in expanding our knowledge of nuclear weapons and thinking about how do we envision a path forward without these kinds of weapons of mass destruction.
One small presentation case contained an enormous story.
One of the exhibit cases shows the original New Yorker magazine that carried in its entirety the John Hersey report on Hiroshima. It's a very large format. It's quite remarkable looking. But this was where the New Yorker put an extremely innocuous cover on of people swimming and all kinds of summer recreation and horseback riding that had nothing to do with the content. Because if they put the content on the front, there may have been problems. This way, the article got to run intact and, of course, was extremely powerful. Tanya, what was one of the more remarkable responses to this when it came out? And what was the environment into which this magazine, this full-length article, appeared? And what was some of the official response to it?
This article that took up the entire New Yorker was the first time that people in the United States were really aware of the effects of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima in particular in a very humanized way that allowed them to fully understand the human toll of those bombs and the suffering, the long-term suffering that resulted from those weapons. Hersey went over to Hiroshima at a time when it seemed that the story of the atomic bombings had been all but buried. The New Yorker's decision to publish John Hersey's account of five atomic bombing sufferers in detail created huge waves all over the country and a renewed anxiety about nuclear weapons and radiation and the possible existential threat to not only those in Japan, but the possibility of that happening in the United States. And the United States government, in response to that, went to Henry Stimson, who had been Secretary of War at the time, and asked him to sign off on an article that was ghostwritten by McGeorge Bundy. And this article came out in February of 1947. So the New Yorker, Hersey's New Yorker article came out at the end of August 1946. Stimson's carefully orchestrated article, ghostwritten by McGeorge Bundy, came out in February 1947. And that was a very strategically written piece to justify the U.S. need to use nuclear weapons in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was written after the fact, so it did not, in fact, relay the lack of thought placed into the use of those weapons and their implications. It implied that there had been a concerted decision-making process that examined the morality and the ethics of that decision, when in fact the desire at the time was to test nuclear weapons on human populations and to justify the use of the $2 billion that had gone into the production of those weapons. That was the government response in Harper's to rewrite the narrative of the atomic bombings. And also the larger motivation for that was to justify the U.S. nuclear weapons development program and all of the geopolitical dominance that was intended to come from those weapons and their production globally, and to convince the American population that it was necessary to use resources, human and, of course, taxpayer dollars, to pay for the huge push to create these weapons of mass destruction, including the hydrogen bombs that were going to be coming in not too long. What's really interesting about this exhibition case is that to the right of the original copy of The New Yorker is another journal, original copy of the Asahi Graph, and that was published on August 6, 1952. And much like The New Yorker, the cover of the Asahi Graph is innocuous, a beautiful woman sitting in front of a public sculpture. But on the inside of the magazine is a depiction and a story about the effects, very graphic depiction of the burnt and charred, scarred bodies of still living atomic bombing sufferers. And this was really the first time in Japan that the Japanese public was also made aware of the suffering and the violation of human bodies that had occurred with the U.S. use of nuclear weapons. And it's no mistake that this was 1952, when the United States occupation was at an end, and that the restrictions and censorship that the United States government had placed upon the Japanese media was no longer in force. And so we see these two original copies of these historic moments side by side in the exhibition. And of course, above them is a photograph from the Peace Resource Collection of a devastated atomic bombed Nagasaki. And all the archival materials that are in this exhibition, all of the images framed on the walls and in the cases, come from the Peace Resource Center's collection at a time, 2 years now after the Oppenheimer film by Christopher Nolan, when the United States has become convinced more than ever that nuclear weapons are necessary to protect its interests. And we're doing a $1.7 trillion upgrade to our nuclear weapons program. That's why this exhibition is critical at this time, for us to think about the way that the narrative was calculated, carefully calculated at the time, to create a sense among United States citizens that nuclear weapons is the only way to engage with other states in an international or global community. So I hope that people will find a way to see this exhibition regardless of where it's at. And it's here until December 5, 2025 at Wilmington College. And then it will be at Oakland University outside of Detroit, Michigan from January 2026. So we hope you'll find it. And then as it travels, we hope that people will continue to find their way to it.
We'll have a picture of that display case up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 743. There will also be what I found to be the most moving of the individual photos on display, a larger-than-life close-up of a terribly scarred man shaving with a straight-edge blade. It's a famous photo taken by Tomotsu Shohai of Yamaguchi Senjihi, a hibakusha. One wall contained an installation of 108 photos of eyes of those who witnessed the atomic bomb explosions at Trinity, Hiroshima, and Nagasaki. The prints are all done in dark red, yellow, orange, and black, and each contains the image of a single eye staring at us in isolation from the rest of the face. Extremely powerful and moving. There will be a picture posted on the website, nuclearhotseat.com. Again, this episode is number 743. This exhibit is emblematic of the work of the Peace Resource Center of Wilmington College. This is the group that chose my play and produced its presentation to honor their 50th anniversary of founding. I could not be prouder, more moved, or more humbled as I understand the true nature of the PRC and what it stands for. I could go on, but by then it was time to go to the theater for the staged reading of Atomic Bill and the Payment Due, and we'll have that part of the story in just a moment. But first, I've been producing Nuclear Hot Seat every week for more than 14 years, and Atomic Bill and the Payment Due is the culmination and distillation of what I've learned, what I want to say, what I hope to launch into the world to help it turn away from the nuclear madness. Admittedly, I doubt that anyone would want to sit and listen to me discourse on my nuclear concerns for 2 straight hours. I'm good, but I'm not that good. But by embedding my thoughts, concerns, fears, and observations in a group of characters who have their own stories and act them out on each other, I believe I have a better shot at getting people to listen and understand. Was I right? Keep listening to learn the answer. I could not have discovered the subject matter and written the play without Nuclear Hot Seat. The steady exposure to nuclear information from producing 742 weekly episodes allowed me to distill the nuclear message into a single 2-hour script, one that entertains and moves people to communal empathy. Without this podcast, there would be no play. And how it came about is actually part of the play itself. Now I'm working to get that script out into the world, and in the process, continuing to produce Nuclear Hot Seat, because there is always more nuclear information to share. So help me keep this program going with a donation of any size. Donations are the only way we keep it going. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible. We make it easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and follow the prompts. Or send your donation directly via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Donate now to keep Nuclear Hot Seat in production. And through it, find the way to produce Atomic Bill and the Payment Due to a full professional production. Whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's the second half of this week's special feature on the Peace Resource Center of Wilmington College and their world premiere staged reading presentation of my play, Atomic Bill and the Payment Due. One of the most important meaningful steps for any playwright is the first time they get to see their work in front of an audience. It's one thing during the writing to hold all the moving parts in your head and heart and hope that it will play, but another to find out if an audience gets it, sits still, listens, laughs, or sits unmoving in the intense silence of listening, responding with hearty applause if not cheers, and no one leaves at intermission. That's the benchmark. To create this presentation, the entire theater department of Wilmington College got behind the production. The cast included not only theater students, but faculty members, community members, and even two homeschooled high schoolers. The show can be produced with as few as 8 actors. That's with some doubling and actors taking as many as a dozen small roles. But here, they spread it out over 20 actors. Quite a luxury. Most sat on chairs placed in rows on 2 sets of risers, the actors getting up to go to the mic when they had a featured bit. But there was also an open area in the middle for more elaborate staging, and 2 long tables with chairs that function variously as desks, offices, a home kitchen, and other locations. That's where the principal actors played their scenes, on their feet and directly interacting, made possible because they were wearing head mics. What I did not expect was the impact created by effects that were added in by director Tara Liddy. A strobe augmented by intense red lights and backed by reverberating sound created the sense of the atomic blasts. In the script, I'd provided 5 archival photos to fill in the picture, but Tara included dozens of visuals to wordlessly set scenes and shift perspectives. There were even film clips of the atomic bomb explosions, the Trinity site, and Hiroshima after the bomb. Add to that the sound effects and music perfectly synchronized to the action on stage, and what resulted provided a true sense of what the fully produced show would be like. The cast, all amateurs, cared deeply about the work and gave terrific performances that well represented my intentions for each of the characters. Many did outside research on the subject material, and all were deeply invested in their roles and the show. About 150 people attended, a great showing. I sat in the middle of the house and could hear people around me laugh, gasp, sniffle, and some were crying as the story played out. At the end, the applause was sustained. Some people stood while they applauded. There were hoots and a few shouts of bravo. I went on stage afterwards to have a brief talk with the audience and congratulate the cast. Then, as we began to clear out, I could not let the moment, one of the peak experiences of my life, pass without comment.
I want to capture the moment. They did an astonishing job. Oh my God, like 2 weeks of rehearsal, no budget, staged reading, script in hand, they did my play. And they did it proud. Oh my God, the audience was fantastic. We had about 140, 150 people here, and nobody left at intermission. They all stayed, major portions stayed for the discussion afterwards. It played. My moments played. The devices I put in kind of going, I wonder if that's going to work. It worked. I'm flabbergasted. I'm enthralled. I am ecstatic. There's an entire thesaurus out there of words that I haven't been able to get to yet. Apply all of them to me. Meanwhile, right now, we have to leave the theater. I don't want to. I basically want to live here for the rest of my life. But there will be another opportunity for this play. I don't know this production, but certainly this play to move forward. Atomic Bill and the Payment Due. It has a future. It made its impact tonight, and I can't wait to see where it's going. So please, join me on the journey. And if you can help it, if you are a theater, if you know a theater, or if you happen to have a couple of $1 million hanging around and a hankering for Broadway, let's talk. It doesn't need a big budget to do a reading or a staged reading. And that's what I'm going after right now. We need this play out into the world. I need this play out into the world. The world needs this play out into the world. I'm going to shut up now and go home, but I'm going to be dancing every step of the way.
I posted the video of what you just heard up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 743, and it's well worth the view because I certainly make a lot of faces. The next night, we had our cast party at a local Mexican restaurant. That's where I got to catch up with director Tara Liddy, who did such an amazing, creative, inventive job in bringing Atomic Bill and the Payment Due to life.
Tara, what did you think when you first got the script?
Oh, when I first got the script, I thought, okay, wow, there's a lot to unpack here. And I just started studying. Oh my gosh, I had to start digging in, and I'm like, there are so many little stories that I've got to learn more about. I mean, there were so many nuggets that led me on this trail of documentaries, podcasts, newspaper writings. I mean, all kinds of stuff. That pretty much became my husband and I's date nights. You know, we were digging into all of this stuff. So you were giving these little nuggets of information in the script that really sent us on a journey. Then after I kind of figured out what I'm reading and understanding all these stories and how they weave in and out of each other, I thought, okay, how do I stage this in a way that is a staged reading without putting too much like director's concept on it, keeping it as a staged reading for your benefit, you know, knowing that part of the purpose was to hear it, to see it, see what works so that you could continue on with your edits, and also stage it in a way that audience members would follow what was happening in the script without seeing the script. And one thing, and this was after, you know, we got into the process and we did our Zoom call, and the question was, what do you want the audience to get out of this? And you said something, just get something. And so I really took that to heart, and I thought, okay, the goal's kind of twofold. One, you've got writing goals to get this play to the next stage. But the second, the goal is that we would all get something out of this. And so how did I need to approach this from an audience perspective? How do I stage this so they get it and they have the opportunity to get something out of it? And so I really kept that at the forefront and took that as a challenge as I approached the piece.
How did you feel after last night?
Elated. I mean, I'm so proud of them, and I'm just so incredibly happy and excited for you. I mean, to see something that you poured your heart into for years. I mean, your story come to life in a way that connects with other people. We didn't live this. You lived this. And your words on paper now being brought to life so other people can see it, hear it, experience it in the beauty of a theatrical setting. I mean, there's power there. I'm just so excited for you, and I just feel like I feel very blessed to have been a part of your journey and seeing this come to fruition.
You did such an extraordinary job. I could not have anticipated how thoroughly the play was presented without any stage directions being read, which are usually a staple with staged reading. Mm-hmm. You really brought it to life so that people could inhabit it far enough to intuit what a full production would be.
Yeah. You know, I didn't want people to check out. And it's a full-length play. I mean, two acts. And I knew, man, act one and act two are going to be an hour each. And I didn't want to risk losing anyone. And I'm like, they need to hear this. We have a captive audience. How can we keep them there? And there won't be lots of glitz and glitter like you see in a normal theatrical production. So what can we do to keep them in the seats listening? Because your words are meant to be heard. And I didn't want to miss that opportunity. So yeah, that I held very close to my heart. You know, I think one of the best things is to hear people since last night say, oh my gosh, I'm not a history person. I was so drawn into this production. I just couldn't get enough of it. I just wanted to hear more. I mean, even high school kids that came were saying, I wasn't real sure what was happening in the beginning. And the more I heard, the more I got sucked in. And I wanted to know more. And they learned so much in one night. I just can't help but think that they're researching today and trying to find out more, you know? I just think that's cool. That's so cool. So sweet.
Director Tara Liddy, whose official title at Wilmington College is Director, Center for Service and Civic Engagement. At the party, I also took the opportunity to let Tanya Mouse weigh in on why she selected the play and what it meant to her.
I'm talking with Tanya Moss, who is the director of the Wilmington College Peace Resource Center and is the woman who was the linchpin in pulling together the reading, the staged reading, the brilliant staged reading of Atomic Bill and the Payment Due that happened last night. We're at the cast party right now, which is what the noise is about. But Tanya, as long as I have you here, why did you choose the play and how do you think it went last night?
The Peace Resource Center is an archives of historical materials, but we're really interested in the arts and bringing the history to new audiences in a different way that will connect with them. Other than, although research and the scholarship is hugely important to understanding of nuclear, finding other ways to connect with younger audiences and with different audiences is huge on our mind at the Peace Resource Center. And so when Libby talked to me about her play, I just thought it was such an exciting way to bring this history to a new group of people. And I knew because of the work that Libby does that this history would be informed, that it would be truthful, and that it would be extremely well researched. So I was really excited to see it come alive in theater. So I feel, you know, just so grateful that we were able to have the opportunity.
And what was last night, the actual staged reading? What was that like for you and how do you feel it was received?
Well, it was just thrilling to see the theater program at the college put this together, because when I thought of a staged reading, I thought of people sitting in a circle and, you know, just kind of reading their part, switching from one person to the next. But what the theater department did is it was much more than a stage reading. It was almost a play in and of itself with lighting and sound effects and imagery, and it was very dramatically and expressively performed. The cast really embodied the characters and the personalities and the richness that Libby wrote into those characters. And so it was just thrilling to see the play come alive like that and beyond our expectations in every single way. And the audience received it. It was great to hear the laughter and to hear the jokes and the humor hit home with the audience. It was just a wonderful experience.
Anything you'd like to add?
Well, I think this play should be out there in the world, and I think it needs to be performed, and it needs to continue to be performed. And so I hope there'll be lots of theaters throughout the country that will take this up and do it justice, and I'm so excited to see what happens with it.
And always, the Wilmington College Peace Resource Center will have pride of place in the program as the place of origination.
Thank you, Libby.
Tanya Mouse, director of the Peace Resource Center at Wilmington College. I moved on to talk with several of the cast members who were there.
Your name is?
Ollie Basta.
Ollie, what role did you play and how did you feel about that character?
So I played the role of Jesse Keever. It was truly an honor to be able to portray this role that Libby has written, and so much of herself was put into this character, and it was truly an honor, and it was one of the most incredible roles I think I've ever played, just because I got to meet you, and speaking with you and meeting you and having these conversations, I can tell how passionate you are about not just nuclear issues, but everything you do, and it makes me so blessed that I got to portray Jesse in a sort of way you as well on stage.
Thank you for that, and how much did you know or understand about nuclear, and how much has your perspective been influenced by the play?
I actually worked with Tanya at the Peace Resource Center a few years ago, and with my work with her, I learned a lot more about nuclear than I had ever really thought of before. So I'm a history major, and obviously in school they teach us about the atomic bombings and how it ended World War II and everything like that, but I didn't really know a whole lot past that, or really knew a lot about the science, or really all the different processes that led up to the creation of the bombs. And working with Tanya in the Peace Resource Center really just opened my eyes to that world and made me want to advocate for nuclear, you know, disarmament. I think working with Tanya and kind of seeing that advocacy work sort of lit the match and lit the fire in me, my little advocist heart. I did know probably a little bit more than the average person, but working on this show, hearing the descriptions of the bombs portrayed by like people actually speaking them on stage made it hit so much harder. And after Atomic Bill says like his big old speech about how beautiful the bomb was, like Jesse as a character is feeling very deeply about that, but also Ollie as an actor is feeling very deeply about that. And I tried to present that in my presentation as much as I could, and I think I did a good job.
You did a great job.
Thank you.
You truly embodied the character as needed and helped support the other actors in what you were doing. You were the glue that held it together, and you did a great job of sticking the pieces. Thank you so much for your work in bringing my play to life.
Well, I just want to thank you for trusting us and believing in us, and I'm really, really happy that we made it as beautiful as you wanted it to be.
That you did.
Erica, but I go by Ari.
What roles did you play?
I was some of the interviewers and reporters, and I was also young Jesse.
What was it like for you to be involved in a play that had so much nuclear information in it?
It was kind of eye-opening. I wasn't expecting there to be that much information, and it like completely changed my point of view on nuclear.
Do you find yourself thinking about nuclear differently when it comes up in the headlines in the news?
100% yes.
Next, Cecilia Hunt.
I played Flo, Bill's wife. I really enjoyed the opportunity to kind of be in the realm of activism in a more artistic way. When I was in college, I was with the Amnesty International Club on campus, and my favorite actions that we took were typically those of a more artistic nature. Visual displays, artwork to get people to notice what was going on, and I really liked stepping back into that realm.
How did you feel about working with this kind of material?
I actually grew up near Lake Erie, very close to the Perry Power Plant, and so I did not have the typical tornado drills during school that they had down in southern Ohio. I had nuclear meltdown drills growing up. It definitely brought up some memories that I would joke with the cast asking, oh, don't you remember in school being told, all right, we're going to have our nuclear power plant drill now? And nobody else seemed to have that experience down here. So it was very little bit of familiar information and then a whole wealth of information that was new and exciting to learn about. Listening to your podcast has definitely opened a whole new realm of information that I feel like has been hinted at around me before, but I've never delved into.
And what do you think you're going to do with this new information?
I'm going to continue listening to your podcast, of course. It definitely reminded me of the passion that I used to feel in the realm of activism. It made me kind of miss being a part of that, being part of different conversations and just seeing kind of what groups are available in my area that we can kind of take a look at what we can do for our communities and the effect that we have. You know, our community affects the one next to us and the one next to them, and you know, it's all intertwined, so got to see what we can do in our own small way.
Kevin Wall took on the pivotal role of Atomic Bill, William L. Lawrence.
What was it like for you to step into this play, this character, and portray him on the stage?
It was a challenge. It was very rewarding. The role of Bill was very meaty. I went through the whole spectrum of emotions throughout the show, and it's nothing that you get to do regularly. Just going from like happy and reaching for your goals, but also getting frustrated and breaking down completely. It was intense, but very rewarding.
How did being exposed to this information and actually having to dwell on it and even memorize parts of it. What did that do to you or for you in terms of your understanding of nuclear, or how did it embellish what you already knew?
Okay. We grew up learning about, you know, the atomic bombs and the effects that they had, but my generation, at least, we were still in the mindset of these were very powerful things that shouldn't be used anymore, but they were necessary for the job at the time. And growing up near Dayton, where one of the planes is on display, that narrative was very kind of strictly enforced. So going into this, I had never heard of William Lawrence or Burchett or any of the other characters in this show. So it's been very enlightening to not only dig back into that knowledge, but also have a more mature perspective on it and get those other sides. So it's been good. Thank you for the opportunity.
Regarding the plane that Kevin mentioned, that was Boxcar, the plane that dropped the bomb on Nagasaki, and it is on display at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base near Dayton. I was able to visit the plane while I was there, and I will have that report in an upcoming Nuclear Hot Seat. There were a lot more actors present who I had a chance to speak with.
Timothy Larrick. I played Carl Grossman, General LeMay, and Henry Keyes.
How much did you know about nuclear before coming into this play? And how did what you learn as a result of it impact you?
All I knew about nuclear was that they dropped the bombs and that they're building reactors for energy. I'm a history buff, so I learned so much from all this information in this play. All the background and everything, and the different people and the stuff that they did or didn't do, I had no clue about any of that. So it really opened my eyes and makes me really think about what our futures are going to be like.
What do you think you'll be doing with this information going forward?
Spreading it to people I know. We had choir practice tonight, and there were, let's see, one, two, three, four. There were four choir members that were there last night. There were more people from the church, but only four in the choir. And they were telling me how much they learned, how much it moved them, and the fact that just sitting there, and even though it wasn't completely fully staged, they listened to everybody's story, and then the special effects and the sound effects and the lighting and everything, they said, we felt like we were right there when they dropped the bomb. We felt like we were right there in the midst of all that action that was going on. So they were really moved. They really loved the show. You did a great job.
His comments always put a smile on my face. One of the remarkable aspects of the cast is that two high schoolers, twin brothers who are homeschooled, auditioned and did the show as part of the enrichment of their homeschooling process. First, Dominic Oriole. What was it like for you to be in a play with this much historical information about the atom bomb?
This really changed me a lot. I learned a lot of new stuff doing this, and it's quite a surprising show too.
How did the information change you?
It hit me out of nowhere. It's hard to put into words of what this did to me.
And what do you think you're going to do with this information going forward?
Put it in my head and just keep on learning.
That was Dominic. Now his twin brother, Jackson Oriole.
I played a newsboy and a reporter, and a student reporter.
What was it like for you to be involved in a project that had this much nuclear atomic information in it?
It was pretty interesting. I mean, I'm not a war buff, but like, it was pretty sad to hear all about those many people that died, and it's just tragic to hear about it. So I just want to make sure that people will look for your nuclear podcast, like, to see how bad it was.
As teenagers who were underage, high schoolers, both boys needed adult supervision while they were working on the play, and that gave me the opportunity to speak with their mother, Tanya Oriole, about some of the other impact that working on this play has had.
A young high schooler said she hates history, but found the show very intriguing. She was fully engrossed in the entire show. My parents said it was very thought-provoking, and they're in their 80s, so they thought it was very thought-provoking. And I just enjoyed it. Enjoyed every part of being a part of it and learned so much.
What might you be doing with the learning, what you've learned about nuclear and about atomic?
Actually exploring more to see what we can do to help, how it's affecting my kids as they are, you know, they're 19, how it's affecting them growing up, how it's affected us. My dad served in the Navy during Vietnam, how it affected his time in the service and what he may have been exposed to as well, because he's gone through 3 cancers in the past 8 years and has survived them all. Someone actually at a doctor's appointment said, what has he been around that he's had 3 cancers?
Not even the crew was immune to the impact of the show. Here's assistant stage manager Elaine Groves.
I am a freshman this year, so it was all pretty new. In high school, we kind of discussed the Japanese standpoint from it, but we never really discussed the American standpoint, so it was really cool to see both sides of the story compared to just what the schools want to teach us.
How has this changed your perspective on World War II and the atomic bombings?
It definitely wants me to become more involved in the story. Obviously, a lot of kids my age don't understand exactly what's going on, and we only ever hear one side. So just being more involved and informing other people around me, just talking with others around me, whether that's other college students, using social media, any way to get the word out.
Finally, 2 days after the play, the director, Tara Liddy, received an email from Vivian Noble. She is a sophomore and Aggie's secretary for the Campus Agricultural Communications and Leadership Council, a prestigious position. Vivian wrote, in part, "Wow, what a play that was. It blew any expectation I had out of the water. It was such a wonderful way to tell the story of the people behind the atomic bomb's history. It was very emotional, and I found myself drawn in and wanting more." And after going over some specific points of interest, she ended, "This play truly was a piece of art, and I will truly never see nuclear the same way." So there you have it. Atomic Bill and the Payment Due has met its first audience, been proven to be a massive success on a minimal budget, a limited rehearsal schedule, an amateur cast, and a book-in-hand staged reading. Where can it go from here? That is where you come in. I've already heard from a number of activist groups and theaters about holding their own readings or staged readings, and I want to hear from more. I'm also open to outreach from producers, directors, and offers of professional representation. It would be great to have one or more presentations of the play up and running in time for next year's Trinity anniversary on July 16. I'm also looking into publishing the script for direct purchase. So if you know a theater, or are a theater, or have the resources to produce the show yourself, let's talk. You can always get to me through my email, info@nuclearhotseat.com, or through the contact form on the Nuclear Hot Seat website. The play is a powerful piece of theater, an educational tool, and a potential turning point in the way nuclear is perceived. How far can it go? And can you help it get there? Let's put our heads together and figure that out. Meanwhile, I will continue to link on the website to articles about Atomic Bill and the Payment Due by Carl Grossman, Greg Mitchell, and others. For now, this has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, September 22nd, 2025. If you're ready to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's the easiest way to never miss a single episode. Go to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a big yellow box. You really can't miss it. If you put in your first name and email address, every week you will get just one email that contains the link to that week's show as soon as it posts and a short description of its content. You can also sign up on your favorite podcast channel. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate in honor of Atomic Bill and the Payment Due, or just because you love this show,
Thank you. Any amount will help us out, and we really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby, Halevi, and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that as William Shakespeare wrote, all the world is a stage. And that means that when it comes to nuclear, we have got to change the script. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.